Lisboa,
Bruxelles,
Sofia,
Warszawa.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Hello and welcome to The Europeans, the show that helps you digest at least some of what is going on this vast and vibrant continent of Europe. I'm Dominic Kramer, one of your hosts, speaking to you from my home in Amsterdam, and I've got a Katie Lee down the line in Paris. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. And this is an exciting week, isn't it? Because we aren't just a podcast this week.
No, we're also on the radio. So a special hello if you're listening to this via NPR in the United States, RTE in Ireland, CBC in Canada, or ABC in Australia, among other places. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you to our friends at the Inside Europe show from Germany's Deutsche Welle, who have very kindly gifted us their weekly slot this week and let us hang out with you instead. And because there's quite a lot of people listening this week who might not have heard The Europeans before, we should probably spend a minute explaining what this podcast is, shouldn't we?
We probably should, yeah. You can probably tell that we are both British by background. That's where we both grew up. But we actually both don't live in the UK and have citizenship of other countries. Katie is also French. I'm also German, but I live in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And we started this podcast after Brexit happened because we were a bit confused as to like why people had made this decision to cut the UK off from Europe. It felt like something that was kind of irrational, but we also thought it was maybe because people really didn't know what was going on in Europe. People really didn't understand the European institutions, and there was very little coming through our regular news sources that told us about what was happening in countries on the other side of the English Channel. And 7.5 years later, we're still here talking about Europe every week.
And miraculously still friends.
Somehow we are still friends. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Probably because we're nerds and nobody else wants to talk to us. Anyway, we usually start each week by telling each other about something that's been happening in our respective cities of Paris and Amsterdam. What's been going on over there this week?
Yeah, well, I've been very preoccupied with egg news, like a lot of people around the world right now. And
of course,
there was a particularly shocking piece of egg news this week here in the Netherlands. We've been advised by our national health authorities not to eat any eggs produced at home by chickens you may have or may not have in your garden.
Oh, wow.
I should clarify, I don't have chickens in my garden. But the reason is quite shocking. They say it's because they've discovered that eggs produced in people's gardens in the Netherlands can produce very high levels of PFAS. Do you know what PFAS is?
Is that that thing that sometimes gets called forever chemicals?
Yes, it is. They're like man-made chemicals that you find in many, many products we use, like non-stick pans or water-resistant jackets. And we know we are all ingesting this stuff. It's like everywhere, and that it can lead to cancers, liver damage, and fertility problems, and many other health problems. But now we know apparently that, at least in the Netherlands, there's a very high concentration of PFAS in the eggs from chickens in people's gardens. And they don't know exactly why, but they think it might be because the worms are full of PFAS.
The worms that the chickens are eating in people's gardens.
Exactly.
That's so depressing. It's like you'd think it would be the most local, healthy kind of eggs you can eat.
I know. It's pretty grim. And just the egg news we need. I mean, the one good piece of egg news for me personally is that I also read that Netherlands is one of the few countries where egg prices are currently dropping.
Oh.
They dropped 3.6% year on year to March. So I should stop panicking about forever chemicals and just enjoy my supermarket bought eggs, I guess.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's funny because I've also got some like depressing nature news from my city.
Oh, yeah?
This week I've been trying to get back to nature in the middle of very grey, concrete-y Paris. My son's creche invited parents to come and help all of these babies and toddlers plant vegetables this week, which was very cute.
Cute.
And quite chaotic, if I'm being honest. I did see several babies who had sort of brown smears around their mouth. They seemed to have been enjoying trying to eat the soil. Oh, well.
Ooh, yummy.
Anyway, we had this lovely, wholesome time planting carrots and tomatoes. And then as we were leaving, I was saying to the director of the creche, like, oh, this is so cool. Like, the kids are going to be able to eat the food that they've grown themselves. That's really nice. And she was like, yeah, unfortunately not. And I said, what? What do you mean? And she said that due to health and safety regulations, Paris is too polluted for the kids at city kindergartens to be allowed to eat anything grown there. Isn't that sad?
That's really dystopian.
Yeah, along with your eggs. I think it doesn't paint a great picture of our continent, to be honest.
Anyway, enough about depressing food stories from Europe. We've got some other things to talk about this week. So I'll tell you what's coming up in our interview slot today. We're going to be heading to Ukraine to hear the story of an organization that used to specialize in corporate intelligence right up until Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But since then, they've pivoted fast, assisted by an army of volunteers to join Ukraine's war effort by harnessing the power of something called open source intelligence. You may be wondering what that is. Well, Daria Verbitska, executive director and co-founder of the Molfar Intelligence Institute, will be speaking to us from Ukraine later on in the show to break it all down. What is this open source intelligence and how is this online sleuthing really making a difference to Ukraine's defense? That's coming up later on the show. But of course, first it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Okay, so time for Good Week, Bad Week, a segment in which we usually try to talk about topics that are a little bit more under the radar. So yeah, we won't be discussing the upcoming conclave following the death of Pope Francis. We feel that is getting enough coverage already. I also feel like before we start, I should mention again, as longtime listeners already know, Good Week is not an endorsement and vice versa. We're not necessarily being shady in who we hand out our bad week to.
Aren't we?
Well, not always. And a final housekeeping notice before I get started. My bad week this week is the part of the show that is brought to you in collaboration with leading radio stations across Europe as part of a partnership with Euronet Plus.
So who are you actually going to give your bad week to this week, Dominic?
I've decided to give my bad week to Hungary. Last week, the Hungarian parliament passed a constitutional amendment backed by the Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, codifying a law that the government passed in March, banning events held by the LGBTQ plus community, including, most notably, Pride. Mm. So yeah, you may have heard about this Pride ban that was passed in mid-March in Hungary. It did make quite some headlines. This constitutional amendment creates a constitutional backing to that Pride ban law. And that was a law that gives the state permission to use facial recognition software to identify people who organize or attend events such as Pride. Those people can be fined up to 200,000 Hungarian forints, which is about 500 euros.
Wow. But just so I understand this thing properly, was it actually necessary for this constitutional amendment to pass in order for the bill to be like fully functional?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I must admit, I'm no specialist in Hungarian law, but I heard a political scientist in Budapest talking to DW News, Melana Barley, and she was talking about exactly this issue. She said, actually, that the constitutional amendment was pretty much symbolic and that it has no practical or legal necessity.
Okay.
But yeah, even if it is mainly symbolic, I'm sure that symbolism will be being felt by LGBTQ plus people in Hungary this week.
Absolutely. What is actually in this constitutional amendment? What does it actually say?
Yeah, well, I should mention that there are a bunch of things in this constitutional amendment related to a range of topics. So it's not just about this Pride bill, but the bit that is supposedly related to Pride is the assertion that a child's right to moral, physical, and spiritual development takes precedence over all other rights, apart from the right to life, but including the freedom of assembly. And Pride is apparently relevant here because Orbán's government are trying to claim that a child's moral, physical, or spiritual development is endangered by a Pride march.
Hmm.
I feel like we could insert crickets here, like they do on reality TV programs.
Oh, that's grim though. And not the first time you've heard that kind of thing from Orbán's government, obviously.
No, it's not. The constitutional amendment also takes on some other political targets of the Hungarian government as well. It enshrines into law that the state only recognizes two sexes, male and female, effectively denying the recognition or existence of some transgender, non-binary and intersex people. And the constitutional amendment also makes it possible for Hungary to strip a dual national of their Hungarian citizenship if they are deemed to present a threat to the security or sovereignty of Hungary. Mm. Now, this amendment is being seen by many analysts as an intimidation tactic to opposition, and it is expected to be used against people such as independent journalists and people working for NGOs. That's actually been confirmed by some members of the ruling Fidesz party. Hmm. So it could have a pretty chilling effect. And yeah, therefore I am giving bad week to Hungary. And it's a bad week for diversity, a bad week for the freedom of assembly, a bad week for equality, and yeah, a bad week for human rights in Hungary.
And I don't want to drop you in it or anything, but originally, listeners, Dominic wanted to give Hungary a good week this week, but then you texted me saying, I don't think I can make this a good week story. This is very clearly a bad week story. And I very kindly obliged. But just out of curiosity, how were you planning on selling this to me as a good week?
Yes, okay. Well, at first, I really wanted to like look at this optimistically and give good week to Hungarian civil society or the Hungarian LGBTQ plus community for showing courage in the face of oppressive legislation. But yeah, even if that is also true, I think it would have been a bit hard to swallow. I think it might have been a little bit toxically positive. But that said, there are a few things I want to mention that might give people like a little bit of hope. I was really impressed by this march that was organized by this satirical political party in Hungary called The Dog with Two Tails. They organized a protest in Budapest in the run-up to the constitutional amendment vote, and I thought the concept was brilliant. It was a march for gray pride, not gay pride, but gray pride, as in the color.
Oh.
And thousands of people took to the street in their most drab gray clothes, waving monochromatic rainbows. And the marchers were like, ironically calling for sameness to be celebrated. Let's all be gray and not differ from each other at all. And I thought it was just a really clever and humorous way to illustrate that what Orbán and Fidesz are pushing for is the eradication of color, the eradication of diversity, trying to make everyone the same. So yeah, it was an example of an action that made me think I could maybe spin this as good week. But yeah, another reason I was seriously considering framing this as good week was because of some hints of maybe, possibly, there might be action coming from the European Union to help protect the fundamental rights of LGBTIQ people in Hungary. There was actually a cross-party delegation of 5 members of the European Parliament that went to Hungary last week on a rule of law mission to discuss an array of concerns in Hungary around the central values of the EU and democratic backsliding. So they weren't just there to discuss and investigate the Pride ban, but that was obviously high on the agenda, seeing as this is something that is happening now. And actually, quick sidebar, in a sign of quite how bad relations have gotten between the EU institutions and Hungary under the rule of Putin-friendly Viktor Orbán, Politico had a scoop this week that apparently the members of this delegation were given anti-spying phone pouches to protect their devices from spyware and espionage whilst in Hungary.
Wow. That is quite telling, isn't it?
It really is. And I mean, it's not the first time that there have been reports of the Hungarian government using spyware against civil society or opposition figures. But I found it quite striking that it's now apparently being taken seriously enough that the EU actually provided the MEPs with these metal-lined pouches. Mm. Anyway, the delegation were there for a few days and they concluded their trip with a call for the European Commission, the executive body of the European Union, to intervene. They want this latest and anti-LGBTIQ legislation to be added to the ongoing infringement case against Hungary that is awaiting a judgment in the European Court of Justice right now.
Okay, interesting. Do we know otherwise how the European Commission itself is planning on responding to this anti-pride legislation?
Well, at the time of recording on Tuesday, the 22nd of April, no, we don't know for sure how the commission will respond. That's also why I felt it was a bit premature to frame this as good week for the fight back against this, frankly, pretty oppressive legislation.
Fair enough.
The European Commission has put out a statement saying they're aware of the constitutional amendment. They say that they need to examine the amendment very carefully from the perspective of European law. And as for actions, they will, quote, not hesitate to act if necessary.
Okay.
So this does suggest that something could be coming. And yeah, as I just mentioned, the EU and Hungary are already in the middle of a legal tussle. Well, actually, they're already in the middle of a few legal tussles. But there is this one long-running legal tussle specifically related to Hungary's treatment of the LGBTQ plus community that I referred to earlier, because the MEPs would like to see the case expanded to include the Pride ban. Mm. And the commission began those infringement proceedings against Hungary back in 2021 after Hungary passed this so-called anti-LGBTQ plus propaganda law that year, which the EU say is potentially in breach of the fundamental rights of the European Union and fundamental EU values. Those legal proceedings against Hungary are backed actually by 16 EU member states. So that's 16 other European Union countries that are taking Hungary to court. Mm-hmm. And they're currently awaiting a ruling in the Court of Justice, which is expected in June this year. So quite soon.
And that law from back in 2021, that was also supposedly about protecting children, right?
Yeah. Viktor Orban and his political party always frame these anti-LGBT laws as necessary in order to protect children. That anti-propaganda law from 2021 that triggered the European Commission's proceedings curtailed depictions or discussions of LGBT issues in media or education that could be seen by children. It famously led to books like that hit young adult graphic novel that's been turned into a Netflix series, Heartstopper, having to be wrapped in bookshops so that children couldn't open them in the shop and be damaged. Such a damaging book, Heartstopper. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Their eyes. Yeah. Protect their eyes.
Anyway, it's all Orban doing his populist war on woke thing. And that was seen again this week because after the constitutional amendment vote passed, he said, in Hungary, common sense matters.
Okay. Why do you think he's focusing his attacks on the LGBTQI community? Like, is banning Pride really the most important thing for him to be doing right now?
Well, no. I think it's very easy to make an argument that no, it's not the most important thing for him to be focusing his attention on. There are huge problems that need fixing in Hungary. There's very high inflation. Hungary has actually some of the highest inflation in the EU right now. And there's a crumbling healthcare system and, of course, a war in bordering Ukraine. Many Hungarians that I've read or heard talking about this think he has moved his attack on Pride up the agenda simply because he has an election coming up next year and he's currently struggling in the polls, which is a pretty new sensation for Orban and his Fidesz party. Mm. It's the most vulnerable he's looked in the polls since he began this stint as prime minister back in 2010. And that's largely because of the meteoric rise of a Fidesz dissenter, his former ally, Peter Mayer, who I think we've discussed on the show before, right?
Yeah, a couple of times, I think.
And yeah, he only launched his party, Tisza, in 2024, but he already achieved a pretty strong second place result in the European elections last year. And he is now leading in most polls today. So Orban's rule is under threat. And it seems like he wants to use this anti-Pride legislation as a way of reminding people that he is this so-called common sense politician here to protect your Hungarian children. And I guess he wants to forget that his party had a huge political crisis last year when his justice minister had to resign for pardoning a man involved in a cover-up of a child sex abuse case.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's a distraction tactic. And I should probably mention that, yes, the disgraced justice minister in question who had to resign, just so happens to be the ex-wife of this Peter Maillard, Orban's current political opponent.
Indeed.
It's complicated. But anyway, I see this pride ban as just another example of a strongman politician picking on a minority group to try and create a common enemy for his voters, who they can blame for problems in society. And in this case, it's queer people, but it's also often migrants who come under political attack from politicians like Orban.
But this up-and-coming political rival of Orban's, Peter Maillard, what has he said about this push for anti-pride legislation?
Yeah, that's an important point, because some are seeing this legislation as a trap that Orban is setting for Maillard. Maillard has to keep a pretty broad coalition of supporters together if he's going to have any chance at governing Hungary next year. And if he comes out in like vocal support of Orban's anti-LGBTQ plus laws, he'd of course lose a ton of the more progressive-minded people who are hoping for an end to the Orban era. But on the other hand, if he defends LGBTQ plus rights loudly, there is the suggestion that he might lose some of his more conservative supporters who are fed up with Orban but are still pretty socially conservative. There's actually a great piece in Balkan Insight that I'll share a link to examining this law and Maillard's strategy to generally avoid weighing into anything that has to do with anything vaguely identity politics-y. But yeah, Maillard has been quieter than many progressive people in Hungary would like on this issue. But he did say after the Pride ban was first passed in March that Orban was doing it just to distract from the cost of living crisis in Hungary, and that if he is elected, he will protect the right of assembly.
Okay, so it's still a little bit up in the air what's going to happen. And certainly when it comes to Europe's response, we're waiting to hear how the European Commission is going to respond.
Yeah.
What about the people who organise the Pride Parade in Budapest every year? Are they cancelling it? Are they planning to go ahead despite the ban? What's going on?
Yeah, it seems like they want to go ahead despite the new law and this constitutional amendment. Pride in Budapest is scheduled for June the 28th, so that's just over 2 months away. So who knows what will happen in the intervening period. Maybe the EU will be able to get some interim measures in place to protect the march and the right of assembly. Or yeah, maybe the marchers are going to risk it and go out and celebrate Pride even despite the law. But yeah, I have to say, as a gay man myself, I've always lived in countries where, at least up until recently, I had the privilege to enjoy Pride marches mainly as a celebration, as much as a fight for our rights. Mm. And this development in Hungary is just another wake-up call to me. I think Pride is going to feel very different for a lot of people this summer in a lot of places around the world. I mean, just this week in the UK, there was also this Supreme Court ruling that has devastated the trans community there. And I'm not even going to start with what's going on in the USA. But yeah, Pride looks like it's going to be very much needed.
It should be such a joyful event, you know. It's about people saying they're proud of who they are and being able to celebrate that is a beautiful thing. But as you say, I think those gatherings this year are going to be tinged with a bit more anger and a real sense of fight back.
Well, time for something completely different. Who's had a good week, Katie?
Yeah, I'm going to have to attempt an abrupt, awkward shift in the tone now, moving on from Hungarian human rights. And this is one of those editions of Good Week that's actually probably a bad week. But as you have forced me to take Good Week this week, and I really, really want to talk about this story, I am going to try as hard as possible to jam this story into the shape of a good week. Okay?
Okay. Thank you. I really appreciate it, Katie.
All right. Please humor me. I want to tell you about a Danish couple called Mette Helbeck and Flemming Hansen. They are both chefs by profession. They came up through the famous Copenhagen fine dining scene. And then in 2017, they move across the border, this couple, from Denmark to Sweden. And they open a kind of eco-resort. Mm-hmm. It's called Stedsans, which roughly translates from Danish as a sense of place. And it's in a very beautiful part of southern Sweden called Halland, on the edge of a lake.
Sounds beautiful.
Yeah. So like, just imagine this very sort of Instagrammy, eco-friendly kind of holiday destination, like cozy wooden cabins, no electricity, refreshing lake swims, a floating sauna, and food that seems to be mostly plates of delicious hyper-local vegetables with like flowers scattered all over them.
Transport me there now.
Mette and Flemming are big into permaculture, which is an approach to growing our food that tries to look at the well-being of the entire ecosystem rather than, you know, trying to maximize our crop yields. And they really market Steadsands as a place that tries to put that into practice. They see it as a political project as well as a holiday destination and a business. This couple become quite big sustainability influencers on Instagram. And even though this couple admit that running an off-grid resort with loads of bugs and mud and no electricity is not always as dreamy as it looks on Instagram, the business does seem to be, from the outside at least, quite successful. You know, it gets written about in magazines like Vogue. The New York Times describes it as magical. The place is often fully booked. And the way that people who've stayed there describe it, it does seem to be this really special place where people have these beautiful back to nature experiences, and they eat delicious food, and they take lots of nice pictures that they can take home and post on their Instagram when they have ended their weekend of digital detox and are back in the city, horribly addicted to their mobile phones once again. Anyway, fast forward 8 years. Unfortunately, things at Steadsands look very different. You maybe saw the headlines last week about Meta and Fleming. Headlines that say things like, couple behind Swedish eco-resort flee to Guatemala, leaving behind 158 barrels of human waste. Did you see these headlines?
I did see these headlines, and I actually haven't read about it, so I'm really pleased you're going to tell me more about what happened. But I still haven't got to like why this is at all good week, but...
We'll get there in some time, but okay. Not right yet.
Okay.
But anyway, this story has come out of a cross-border investigation by two newspapers, Politiken from the couple's home country of Denmark and Dagens Nyheter in Sweden, where the resort actually was. And according to this investigation, Meta and Fleming got into such spectacular financial trouble that they ended up owing somewhere in the region of 6 or 7 million Swedish krona of debt to the tax authorities. More than 500,000 euros.
Whoa.
Pretty eye-watering amounts of money.
Yeah.
Steadsands as a business has now sadly gone bankrupt. And the way the couple have decided to deal with this is to flee the country, quietly moving to Guatemala to open a new hotel business, leaving behind a bunch of angry investors, disappointed customers who paid for bookings and have now been told that they can't have their money back, and all of these barrels of poop, human poop.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Can you explain, like, why they left behind all the human poop? Like, 158 barrels, you said, right?
I did, yes. I mean...
That's a lot of poop.
It's a lot of poop.
Why did they keep all this poop?
This is the aspect of this story that has garnered the most attention. The journalists actually visited Steadsands after Meta and Fleming fled to Guatemala. So they filmed the barrels of poop with a drone, as well as from ground level, very thorough. And the claim from the local authorities, at least, is that this human waste has been illegally dumped in these barrels on the site of this eco-resort. Why were there 158 barrels of human feces left at the resort, I hear you ask? Well, in the spirit of sustainability, which is, of course, what this resort was all about, the toilets used by the guests were composting toilets. Do you know what a composting toilet is, and have you used one, Dominic?
That's a very personal question, and
sorry.
Yes, I have.
How was it?
Stinky.
Yeah, this is the thing, right? They are waterless toilets, composting toilets. And that makes them really good for off-the-grid sites. You don't need to be connected to the sewer network. So basically what happens is you do your business, it drops into a box underneath, and then you pour a scoop of sawdust or some other absorbent material over the top of it. And that both helps to make the process less gross for the people using the toilet after you. And it also aerates the waste. And that is really important here, because what we're ultimately trying to do with these toilets is try to turn human poop into something that can be used as fertilizer. Now, I'm not going to get into it too much, partly because I'm not sure our listeners want me to talk about poo for ages, and also because there's a very heated debate over the circumstances in which it is safe to use processed human poop from composting toilets as fertilizer. Obviously, people have been using animal manure as a fertilizer since forever. Modern human poop, though, can carry pathogens and parasites, which is why the World Health Organization and many other official bodies are really wary about the circumstances in which you can and should do it. Anyway, according to the local authorities in this part of Sweden, the way that all of this poop was left in these barrels constitutes an environmental crime. And they are saying that as early as 2018, they had inspected the waste management system at Stedsans and found it to be illegal. And here, I think, is where the story gets really interesting, because the couple are saying, it is absolutely outrageous to accuse us of any kind of environmental wrongdoing. You know, after all, these are people who, publicly at least, put sustainability at the heart of everything they do. And, you know, they adhere to strict principles of permaculture and looking after the earth. They insist that they haven't broken any laws, and that the new owner of this piece of land was aware of the 158 barrels of poop. Half of the barrels were apparently, according to them, ready to use as compost, and the other half will be mature a year from now under what they insist are perfectly acceptable processes under Swedish law. I mean, if you want to be business-minded about it, you could argue that the poop should actually be seen as an asset. It's a business asset that the new owner can enjoy and benefit from. It's a good thing.
Yeah, great. I love this. Maybe we should set up a side business, Katie.
There's good money in poop. Anyway, Mette and Fleming are really presenting themselves as having been harassed and misrepresented by the media. So they're saying, you know, we're being depicted as environmental criminals here, and what is being reported is untrue and unfair.
Okay, so there's a bit of a he said, she said situation going on here. But yeah. Who do you think is actually right?
Well, having looked very closely at both the newspaper's reporting and the way that Mette and Fleming have tried to defend themselves, I think there are arguments on both sides. I mean, some of the stuff that they've been described as doing wrong was stuff like letting the water from, you know, washing the dishes and the pans in their restaurant just run into the earth and the lake. And that was counted as an environmental crime by the local authorities. But, you know, the couple were open from the beginning about the fact that they were doing that. They were even proud of it. They were quite public about the fact that they were using only natural biodegradable soap, so they were pretty sure it wasn't doing any damage. I don't know what detergent they were using, but it does seem potentially unfair for this to be added as like a charge against them and something that they did that was really shady, given that they basically advertised actively that this was part of how they were running things. I mean, in general, I have to put my hands up and say, I am not an expert on permaculture, and I am also not a government health and safety official.
Oh, you're not?
No.
Oh.
I don't know if you noticed. But that limits my ability to see who's in the right here. I do think some of the disagreement between the two sides about whether or not there has been environmental mismanagement here comes from the fact that Mette and Fleming come from a more alternative, naturalistic approach to environmental management. They're kind of anti-system people. Mm. So I do wonder if there might have been an aspect while they were running this place of saying, you know what, we're going to go ahead with what we believe is a respectful way of managing our waste here, regardless of whether it exactly matches what government regulations say. Having said that, I did find the reporting from the investigative journalists to be quite thorough and carefully researched. And I mean, when they visited the site, they did find like human poo that just seemed to have been dumped around fruit trees with stuff like wet wipes in it, which does not sound to me like super careful, respectful management of the environment.
But then you could blame the guests, because I'm sure they said you're not meant to put wet wipes down with a compostable toilet.
Yeah, it's probably these terrible city people who are also Instagramming their beautiful pictures right? The whole time, putting wet wipes into these composting toilets. Naughty, naughty. I mean, personally, my gut instinct is to try and see the best in humanity. And I do believe that this couple really have committed their lives to trying as much as they can to live in harmony with nature. I mean, whether they always achieved that perfectly and whether it actually lined up with what the regulations say is another matter. The Swedish authorities are still investigating what actually happened on this resort and whether the poop handling was illegal. And I won't be surprised at all if it's found that what they did even if it is in line with their own ethical and environmental principles, did indeed break a bunch of regulations.
JD, you still haven't told me why this is good week. I mean, I know I made you do this, but we've got quite far into the story. There doesn't seem much good that's happened.
Okay, fine. I will finally address this. Welcome to chapter 2 of my epic adventure titled Are Meta and Fleming Villains or Not? Because we've talked about this debate over whether they're environmental criminals or not. Now I want to talk about their unpaid taxes. So I am finally getting to Good Week. There's another element to this. This week, I would like to give my good week to tourists heading to Guatemala. Because if you've been thinking of going to Guatemala soon, congratulations, because you can potentially book a stay at Meta and Fleming's new hotel on the shores of Guatemala's beautiful Lake Atitlan, because that is where the couple now live after fleeing their enormous unpaid tax bills in Scandinavia. And it looks like the hotel's going to be really, really nice. They're already taking bookings, and if everything goes according to plan, you should be able to check in for May. Do you find this to be a convincing angle for a good week?
I mean, frankly, I'm just grateful you didn't try and make me squeeze the Pride ban into good week. So yeah, however you can make it work, I'm behind you, Katie.
Thank you. It's quite tenuous, but we're here now.
But hang on a second. They left Sweden without paying all these taxes.
Yes. So here is where even some people in the comments on this couple's social media posts are like, okay, I'd like maybe buy the idea that you guys aren't totally evil environmental criminals in the way that was suggested by some of the media reports about the barrels of poop. But the unpaid taxes are another matter, because they really did owe huge, huge amounts of money. It turns out that even before Meta and Fleming moved from their home country of Denmark to neighboring Sweden, they already personally owed the Danish tax authorities a ton of money from their previous businesses. So they previously run this fruit and veg shop and a restaurant. And despite being very trendy, these businesses apparently weren't as successful as they looked. And the fact that the couple didn't pay their tax bills meant that the Danes just kept adding interest and fines to their bill. And it has mounted and mounted for years after they left their home country. Meta and Fleming have said that if they want the bill just to stop growing, they need to pay back more than 50,000 Danish kroner a month, which is like 6,500 euros. And then there's their unpaid tax bills in Sweden, which are also huge. They have been estimated as being between 6 and 7 million Swedish krona, so certainly more than 500,000 euros or dollars. Now, the way that this couple have talked about these taxes is really interesting. Part of it is that they're just complaining that high taxes and bureaucracy make it really difficult to do business in Scandinavia, especially in the sustainability sector. You know, there's a lot of permits you need and lots of time-consuming paperwork. But they have also said, and I am quoting from their new website here, "The media says that we fled from tax debt. That is not true. We turned our back to a debt that we thought was deeply unfair." And in their social media posts, they have justified this as a kind of protest against the tax system not paying the bills.
Oh.
By pointing to types of government spending that they don't support, like, quote, wars and other things that we don't believe in.
Sure. Ideological opposition to taxes. Yeah, you can always make that case, I guess, but it seems a bit cheap.
It's kind of convenient, right? If you have this huge bill to be like, well, we don't believe in this spending anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people have pointed out on their Instagram, they've said things like, you know, I'm sure you're good people trying to do good things in this world. However, this just seems like you're denying that you have any responsibility to society, despite saying that you're all about sustainability. And, you know, sustainability is about stuff like how we grow our food, but it is also about making a society where we can pay for stuff that we use collectively, like healthcare and education. Also, I'm sorry, but despite offering a quite simple back-to-nature experience, Stedsans was not a cheap place to stay. There does seem to have been some fluctuation in their pricing, but certainly when the New York Times wrote about the resort back in 2019, a single overnight stay for one couple with a 6-course dinner, so pretty fancy, with wine pairings, that single night overnight stay was 750 euros.
Oh my goodness.
And that's back in 2019 for one night. So yeah, this couple are kind of talking about themselves as if they're these like anti-capitalist renegades, but they also... didn't seem to have had a problem charging really quite large sums of money to stay at their hotel. Fleming, the guy in the couple, he has also admitted that while everything was going horribly wrong in the company's finances, he set up companies in the UK and the US state of Delaware, a famously business-friendly tax destination, in an apparent bid to minimize tax payments during their move to Guatemala. They also, controversially, carried on taking bookings well into this year, despite having moved to Guatemala already in December.
Wow.
They took an estimated 91,000 euros worth of bookings that are now just not being paid back because they're bankrupt. And that's quite a lot of angry customers, some of whom are accusing the couple of taking their bookings knowing that the resort was going to have to close, although there is some debate about whether somebody else could run it. There's also a bunch of investors who've lost their money and feel like they really should have been told about Meta and Fleming's unpaid taxes before they invested in the business. And look, I mean, this couple are dealing with a mountain of debt, which is horrible and incredibly stressful. They have four kids who have had to witness all of this, which is really not nice. You know, I say this as somebody who grew up with stressed out parents running their own business. So I do, to some extent, understand this impulse to just say, screw it, let's just leave the country and start again from zero. But I also find it quite hard to swallow some of their justifications for just running away to Guatemala and saying, sorry, we can't pay these taxes. And for convenient political reasons, we also don't feel like we should have to pay them. I'm coming to the end of the story. How are you feeling about Meta and Fleming?
I just feel quite sad, actually, about the fact that these two people who set up something that does sound like it was coming from a place of concern for the environment, and they were trying to do tourism in a way that was more sustainable, which we really need.
Yeah.
I feel quite sad that they've ended up being tax avoiders who carried on taking bookings despite the fact that they'd abandoned the place and left it with loads of poo.
Well, a business asset.
A business asset, of course.
I mean, I don't know. After going on a bit of an emotional roller coaster journey, trying to figure out whether this couple are villains or not, I think I view them with a mixture of compassion and skepticism. And above all, I think the story is a cautionary tale to anyone who wants to blend being an influencer with running a business. Because this couple have received way more attention for their business going wrong than if they'd just been a hotel without that much of an internet presence. I do think there's been a certain portion of the internet that has taken this kind of gleeful pleasure in this story going wrong. And this contrast between this, you know, this dreamy vision of how this place looked on Instagram versus the 158 barrels of human poo that got left over when it all went spectacularly wrong. It does have this element of Instagram versus reality. And I think specifically the fact that they were sustainability influencers, that's a particularly hard type of influencer to be because you're presenting yourself as like inherently virtuous. So people love to see it when you fail. You know, they've said on social media, we're human, we've made a lot of mistakes. And I think it would be good to remember that and to see them as hardworking people who genuinely wanted to do some good in the world, while also, you know, viewing some of the decisions with raised eyebrows. I mean, ultimately, I wish them all the best with this new hotel that they're setting up in Guatemala with some financial help from Fleming's parents. It does look like it's going to have amazing food once again and beautiful recycled bed linen.
And wet wipes around the apple trees.
No wet wipes this time, please, people. But I mean, let's hope that they make a huge success of it, right? Like enough to maybe pay back some of their Swedish and Danish taxes. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would be. Yes. Now, the only reason why our microphones are still on and we're still chatting to each other about Europe each week is because of the amazing support of a very friendly, lovely bunch of listeners who have decided to donate a little bit of money each month because they value the work that we're doing here. We birthed this podcast baby about 7.5 years ago, and I honestly have to pinch myself sometimes when I realize that we've been doing it that long and that people are still listening and willing to donate to make it all possible. So thank you all so much for your continued support of the Europeans podcast, and a special thank you this week to our most recent supporters. Would you like to do the honors, Katie?
Our most recent amazing supporters are Simon, Paul, ooh, someone with a number rather than a name, the mysteriously named 332, B, Vesela, Jeremy, Monica, Jill, Willem, Chris, Alberto, Shimon, Esther, and Will. Thank you all so, so much.
Yes, thank you all so much. You can join them by heading to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. And now, if you don't have the money to be able to support us financially, another way you can help us is by giving us a shout out on social media. Thank you this week to Luigi and Julia, who put out very nice posts about us on Instagram. We really appreciate it.
Easter was supposedly marked in Ukraine by a brief 30-hour ceasefire, which was announced by Russia and agreed to by the government in Kyiv. The whole thing appears to have been pretty meaningless, though. Ukrainian officials said that there was a bit of a slowdown in the fighting, but they also accused Russian troops of violating the ceasefire numerous times, despite having called it in the first place. So more than 3 years into this horrible, horrible war, and despite all of the talk of peace initiatives, especially from the US, the fighting is still very much ongoing. People's towns are still being shelled. People are still losing their lives and their limbs and their loved ones. This week, though, we wanted to talk about the version of the war that has been taking place online for the past 3 years. It's obviously a lot less visible, but the internet version of this war has also been taking place at a furious pace because the stakes are pretty high. As we're about to hear, what happens online has the ability to shape what happens on the ground in a big way. So this week, Dominic, we're going to talk about OSINT. Do you know what OSINT is? I think you do know a little bit.
Well, yes, because we did this interview earlier this week. OSINT, it stands for Open Source Intelligence, and it's a form of intelligence gathering that uses publicly available information to work out things about people and things. It's not a very good definition. Thanks for putting me on the spot, Katie.
You're welcome. Yeah, so it's basically online detective work, right? So for example, it might involve something like looking at a photo and trying to work out where that photo was taken using something like Google Street View to, you know, like identify buildings that you can see in the background. And that kind of sleuthing work has been used in this war, for example, to locate Russian troops within Ukraine and then launch strikes on those targets. So it can have a very, very real world effect. This week, we're going to talk to someone who has been involved in this kind of work in Ukraine. Daria Verbitska was until recently head of the Molfar Intelligence Institute. It is an offshoot of a Ukrainian company called Molfar, which you're going to hear about in a second. But the institute itself is dedicated to using OSINT work to help Ukraine win the war. And they have been applying this technology in some really creative ways. We gave Daria a call in Kyiv.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Daria. Really nice to have you on The Europeans. I wanted to start by talking about the name of your company. I believe there's an interesting legend behind the name Molfar. Could you tell us a bit about the legend behind the name of your company?
Molfar, actually, it's like a Latinized word or name of Ukrainian mythological or magician. It's like a person who can predict the future, and usually he or she works with his or her internal feelings. But in our case, we actually believe that only the facts, not the magic, can shape the truth, the world, etc. And the culture of all of this, predictions, magicians, etc., it's kind of popular in Ukraine. So when people search online in Ukraine for Molfar predictions or something like that, they end up at our website, and we think it's kind of beautiful.
Clever. I mean, it's kind of geeky to say it, but I also like the idea of open source technology as a kind of magic in itself. I mean, the company was founded long before the war, and indeed a lot of its work is still completely unrelated to the war. You know, for example, Molfar works with corporate clients in different countries, carrying out background checks on potential business partners. But when Russia launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, was it immediately obvious that the company might be able to play a useful role in the war effort.
When Russia invaded, everything was changed for our company, as most of our team, actually, they were and they are based in Dnipro, and they stayed there. The problem actually was like in the team, because they felt, you know, like everything changed and maybe there is no chance that everything will get back normal. So we tried to find any ways to strengthen our team and to unite them again. And we decided to change the way where we put our energy, and we chose to work against Russia. So we started with the fact checks, with the missile strikes, the anonymization of some kind of propagandists or military, Russian military, of course. And that brought us really big community. And now we have more than 100,000 followers across our social media. And yeah, we have really big volunteer community. So yeah, now we cannot just give up and forget what we did in 2022 and 2023, just because we have all of that power and probably background.
If I understand correctly, some of what your analysts do involves using tools that are quite easily available to all of us, like Google Maps, or tools that allow anyone to do a reverse image search. But how much of the work involves using more sophisticated tools and artificial intelligence? And what kind of things are your analysts using these tools for?
It really depends on the task. So for military-related investigations, we use tools that wouldn't be relevant or available for civilians. And I can go into details about all of the tasks that are related to military cases, for obvious reasons, but generally we train our students and analysts to work with both free and paid tools, and they are open sourced. So we mentor them through real investigations and often from the scratch. One of our favorite use cases involved, for example, the tool called PMICE. It's a facial recognition search engine. And in one case, we traced the person through a Pinterest using PMICE firstly.
Yeah, PMICE is this tool where you can like get one image of someone and then you find all the images online from that one face, right?
Exactly. But I didn't want to make any advertisement for PMICE, but yeah, no. we are using PMICE. And okay. Using PMICE, we found the Pinterest account where this person have saved tattoo inspirations. And then we matched that Pinterest with the tattoo that we seen in a video previously. And that video was kind of with a sexual character, and that was not showing face. So we built this long chain to identify that one person was the state or local official in occupied territory. Wow. But actually, all of that tools, they're on our website, and there are like hundreds of that tools, and you can feel free to find anything paid or not paid, or free or not free, etc. So it's like open sourced.
Back in 2023, it was reported that Mulfar's analysts had used fake profiles on dating apps using pictures of imaginary women that had been generated using AI to get into conversation with Russian soldiers in the hope that these soldiers would then reveal useful information, for example, about their location and the state of morale among their troops, things like this. Presumably, it's harder to do that kind of thing now because the Russians are aware that this kind of thing is happening, right? Have you had to kind of change strategy, change tactics?
Yeah, that was work of our human intelligence team. And that's kind of not about OSINT. That's about another kind of intelligence. So by the time when the story became public, that particular method was already losing effectiveness because the Russian side had learned from their mistakes and their Telegram channels. They were full of warnings like, do not use dating apps, don't talk to strangers. Actually, they adopted quickly. And these kinds of techniques can work for just a while and not forever. So yeah, methods are changing all the time.
Is there a project from your team that you're willing to talk about and that you're most proud of?
I'm especially proud of our work on helping bringing Ukraine children who were illegally abducted by Russia. Thanks to that project, we brought back more than 400 children.
Wow.
Yeah, the main problem of this project is that that was kind of stopped this year because earlier that was funded by US government. And now we have to raise money for finding them again. Mm. But yeah, probably that's the most important project for me.
Sounds like a very impactful project, a really amazing thing to have been able to have been a part of.
Yeah, that was really nice. You know, that made like a feeling of like your work is really important. It's not just about social media or media outlets, but it's like about lives and yeah. And you felt important and valuable in this life.
So it's very clear that, like, you know, even if this stuff is happening online, it is affecting the real world. If we zoom out in general, what kind of an impact do you think open source intelligence is having on the fight against Russia?
Oh, God, I'm struggling with not answering something like really big impact.
It's too big. It's a big question.
So, yeah, I think that it's kind of really, really big impact because probably every week we have 1, 2, 3 requests from different military or, I don't know, governmental departments for teaching them. That's because they know that open source intelligence works and human intelligence works. So by this request, I'm more than sure that that's really important for our country and for the state.
Well, I mean, long before the war, Russia already had quite a big international reputation for running sophisticated online operations like troll farms, campaigns to interfere in foreign elections and so on. So did you get the sense when the full-scale invasion started that Ukraine had a heavy disadvantage when it came to its ability to fight Russian operations online? And if so, to what extent do you think Ukraine has now managed to catch up with Russia?
Before the full-scale invasion, actually the Russian OSINT culture and OSINT techniques, they were already foreign. In Ukraine, that was kind of new culture that actually even didn't start to form. So after the full-scale invasion, we tried to form this community of OSINT activists, of OSINT culture, etc. And now it works. And now there are like lots of people who are interested in OSINT and provide this intelligence, etc. And now we have this culture and we have the capabilities to compete with the Russian community and Russian OSINT culture. Yeah.
As you mentioned, your investigations have often identified specific Russian individuals allegedly involved in attacks. In some cases, these are really serious attacks, like the strike last summer on the country's biggest children's hospital, an attack that constitutes a war crime under international law. Do you believe you might one day get to see some of the people identified by your investigations in an international court?
Yeah, I believe that actually that will happen. Even now, we are proceeding our data to our government and they are proceeding this data to The Hague. During this time, we identified like thousands of people who were here in Ukraine making some awful stuff. I think that one day we will take part in this. We will take part in this legal history.
If you're listening to The Europeans as a podcast this week, you'll be able to find a link to Molfar's investigative work in the show notes. And if you're listening to this via the radio, you can head straight to their website, molfar.com. That is M-O-L-F-A-R.com. Something I really like about what Molfar have been doing here is like harnessing an army of volunteer geeks to help them out with it. Like it's not just paid members of staff who contribute to these investigations. Like, there are so many people who are good at stuff like squinting at Google Maps and matching the location of somewhere to a place where a photo was taken. And that stuff can be incredibly helpful in the real life effort to help Ukraine.
Yeah, there is something kind of thrilling about this, the possibility to help just by sitting behind your laptop.
Yeah, and you know, as we know, the internet is a very dark place. And when it comes to wars, it can be used in all kinds of ways to spread propaganda and misinformation. But this is one of those times where I think you can really see this positive side of the internet and this, you know, Wikipedia-style approach to random people all over the world coming together and using their spare time to try and help out with something. So yeah, I think it's pretty cool that Morpha have assembled this volunteer army.
It sure is. Welcome to the Inspiration Station, the part of the show in which we recommend some European cultural goodies that we've been enjoying over the past week. What would you like to share with our listeners, Katie, today?
Well, I'm going to be a little bit cheeky on this week's episode of The Europeans, and I'm going to borrow my cultural recommendation from one of this podcast's Patreon supporters, Francesca in Italy. And she recommends a singer from Naples called La Nina. Have you come across La Nina?
No, I don't think I have.
She's so good. I hadn't heard her before Francesca recommended her, but I really like her stuff. It's this kind of fierce, powerful, female, witchy pop. She mixes folk music from her home region of Campania with a modern auto-tune-y kind of sound. Mm. Her big song is a song called Figlia di Tempesta, Daughter of the Storm. That song has blown up on TikTok. And Francesca says you can hear the Arab and Spanish influences in her music, which are testament to the history of her home region in southern Italy. She says, I recommend all of her latest album, Foresta.
I've got a space for some witchy pop in my rotation. I'll add it to my playlist.
What have you been enjoying this week?
Well, I think we've discussed the rise of slow TV in Scandinavia on the show before, right?
Ooh, rings a bell. Can you remind us what it is?
Yeah, well, if you're not aware of the phenomenon, it's a trend that initially took off in Norway when in 2009, the public broadcaster put out a marathon television event that consisted of filming the driver's eye view of this Bergen train line that takes 7 hours.
Yeah.
And they just showed the whole thing. And apparently about 20% of the Norwegian population tuned in at some point to see this incredibly slow but beautiful television. And it's kind of like an antidote to our socially media-ruined brains, you could say. Anyway, the trend has spread since then, and a slow TV show has become incredibly popular in Sweden and has been airing each year since 2019. It's called The Great Moose Migration.
Ooh.
And it's a live stream that airs for 3 weeks on Sweden's SVT broadcaster, in which 30 cameras follow the yearly migration of Sweden's largest animal, the moose, each year as they cross the Ångermanland River to get to their summer grazing pastures.
Hmm.
So last year, the live stream was watched by 9 million people across the world. And this year, the live stream is actually currently up and running, and it started a week early due to warmer weather and some early movement from the moose. Anyway, go check it out if you need some relaxing television to serve as a balm to our broken brains and busted mess of a world.
Sounds lovely. So there's no commentary. It's just mooses.
No.
Meese?
It's just moose. Well, the moose aren't necessarily there all the time. So sometimes it's just like a beautiful bit of trees or water passing down the river, but then you're riveted watching, waiting for a moose to appear.
When will I see my moose? I love this. Can't wait to check it out.
We're almost at the end of this episode of the Europeans podcast, and I always like to end the show with a story to cheer everyone up. A happy ending. And this week it was Earth Day on the 22nd of April, so I thought I'd share an Earth Day-related piece of happy news. Namely, the story of the two teenagers that won the European Earth Prize. 18-year-old Tomáš Čermák from the Czech Republic and 19-year-old Anna Podmanická from Slovakia won this prestigious prize for teenagers by inventing a way to clean water from pollutants and antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Wow!
The two teenagers have created a filtration device that uses cold plasma and sunlight, so photocatalysis, to break down harmful bacteria. Anna had been working on the photocatalysis and Tomáš had been working with the cold plasma. And when the two of them started working together, they innovatively combined those techniques and created this filtration device called Pura, which now has shown to be effective at least on a household scale. And they want to scale it up to be used at a much larger scale.
Love this. The kids are all right, really, aren't they?
They are. Antibiotic resistance is one of the biggest problems facing the world over the next few decades. So anything that can help sort this mess out is amazing news. I mean, what were we doing when we were 18, Katie? Can you believe they're like saving the day and working out how to clean our waterways?
You knew me when I was 18, and I think you can confirm I wasn't doing anything that virtuous.
I can confirm that. Anyway, Anna and Tomáš are also now put forward for the Global Earth Prize, the result of which will actually be released once this podcast is in everyone's ears. But we're recording it just before the winner is announced. So head to theearthprize.org if you want to know if they won.
Oh, well, we're behind them.
We sure are.
That is it for this week's episode of The Europeans. I hope you've enjoyed this journey through Hungary and Ukraine and Sweden and everywhere else in between, especially to the people joining us via the radio this week. We hope it's not the last time that you listen to The Europeans. You can join us on any major podcasting app and indeed on YouTube. If you just search The Europeans podcast, you should find us there.
Also worth checking us out on Instagram, where randomly a video clip of my happy ending from a few weeks ago about the sale of Volkswagen Currywurst has gone viral.
Oh yeah, you're actually getting some unwanted attention. Some of the Germans aren't very happy with you for saying that Currywurst is unhealthy.
I stand by my statement. Processed meat is not healthy, okay? Anyway, thank you for listening. This week's episode was produced by Morgan Childs in Prague and Wojtek Oleksiak in Warsaw. Thank you both. We'll see you all next week for an episode with a very special guest.
See you then. Farewell.
Bye.